Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is a true aficionado of fandom. Author Monica Valentinelli is a writer, artist, and game developer, and fortunately for us, one of her many passions involves Firefly, and she has written several Firefly books and an RPG, and we're here to talk today about the newest book, the Firefly Encyclopedia from Titan Books, which came out mid-November, I believe, right?
Yep, mid-November. It was released first in the States, and then it was released in the UK, I believe, mid-November. So it actually came out on Election Day in the US, if you can believe that.
Oh.
Kind of wild.
Wow. Talk about needing a distraction.
Right, exactly.
Well, welcome, Monica.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
So how
it's
did...
It's true. I do have a lot of fandoms.
Yeah, well, you know, that sort of passion is to be commended and appreciated, because not only did you enjoy these fandoms, you did a deep dive in them to the point where you started writing about them and creating new creations based off of them. And that's something we don't see enough of, I believe. Because that keeps the fandom alive. The fact that anyone can go onto Hulu or Amazon and just watch the episodes at will. The episodes are out there. The movie Serenity is out there. The various memes and jokes that are on the internet. I mean, there was an episode of Castle where Nathan Fillion dressed up as Malcolm Reynolds, and there was an in-joke about the show is gone, let it go. And that sort of love, that sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge at the fans is something that keeps the fans engaged and keeps them coming back for more. So thank you for fueling our obsessions.
Awesome.
So the encyclopedia is an oversized, 300-page glossy book about everything Firefly related. It's got timelines, it's got character profiles, and just beautiful, beautiful pictures galore. How did the inspiration, the idea, the pitch for this one come about?
Well, with a lot of books that are done based on movies or TV shows, sometimes the people behind the scenes have the discussion about whether or not to do the book. It's a little different than if I was to have an original story and pitch it. So in this way, it was kind of in reverse. I'd worked with Titan before in the Firefly Dictionary and the phrase book. So they asked me if I wanted to do, because they were thinking about doing an encyclopedia, and I said, well, yes. So the pitch is with the tie-in stuff. They usually work in reverse because a lot of the publishers, they're looking for people that have not only experience working on that type of work, but also the passion, like you said. I haven't met anybody that works or writes in any of these venues that isn't a fan. So for me, it's like we're creating something that we ourselves would be proud of to have on a shelf. And I feel that attention to detail and quality is something that a lot of us, you know, not just myself, really want to make sure that comes through. Because why else would you spend money on this, right? Like, you want to be proud and see something that you would really enjoy on a shelf. So, yeah,
and
it kind of happened in reverse this time.
Because you hear so many stories of people pitching, you know, like Firefly comic books, Firefly novels,
mm-hmm.
graphic novels. So when it comes to the nonfiction related stuff, they go, okay, who is the biggest geek for this we can find? Let's pick you.
Well, it kind of happens that way for the comics and the novels as well, because, you know, there's all these weird business mechanisms that go on behind the scenes about licensing. And licensing is its own It's its own thing. It's like, because every license is different, and you could have licenses based on a TV show versus a comic book versus a game versus, I mean, it's just very complicated. So, and nobody really cares about the complicated details anyway, but the end result is that a lot of that stuff happens on the company level rather than the individual creator level. And individual creators work within companies or are hired by companies to do that stuff. So it's, you know, I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and I haven't worked on Doctor Who, but, you know, to quote the phrase wibbly wobbly timey wimey, it's very much like that.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work on what you put in the book? Because at this point, Firefly's been gone a very long time. Creeping in on 20 years now.
Oh God.
Yeah. Old. Yeah. It's kind of makes you sit back when you realize that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Thanks for that reality check. I really appreciate it.
But hey, we're still fans. The first, you know, we're still flying.
Right.
We're still flying, right? But
at this point,
you have to find information or behind the scenes stories or unseen pictures enough to attract the other fans, because they probably already have all of the other books. So it's not worth it for anybody, creators, you know, the book publisher or the fans or the person putting together the book, to rehash stuff that's already out there that people already have or can easily get. So what sort of things were you looking for to put in this book, and was there anything that was sort of like off limits?
So a lot of what you're saying is really good insight, because that's exactly the type of conversations that you would have on, it's called a nostalgia property, when not a lot of new material is created for a property. With Firefly in particular, in this encyclopedia, we were lucky because of the Dark Horse comics. The Serenity comics that came out through Dark Horse allowed me to expand the canon and go into details that I normally would not have been able to do, because that was all approved by Joss. So technically, the stuff that came out from Serenity was canonical, whereas some of the extrapolations that we did for the role-playing game, even though all of that canon is within line and it makes sense, logical sense within the universe, somebody might say, well, that's not really canon. That's something that's there for the game to be able to play it, because that's not necessarily part of the story for the main cast, or those are tools that to tell your own story, right? So the comics allowed me to kind of see, okay, well, here's all the canon that I know from the show. And also the YouTube videos that were put out as promotion for the movie. Here's all the stuff that was in the movie and some of the stuff that was behind the scenes. And now I have all these stories from the comics. So with that information, that's how the outline, which is something that I was able to contribute to, this is how the outline would look. These are kind of the things that I think would be really interesting to do. Here's some of the ways that we can expand it so that it's not just a rehash of the show or a reprint of the scripts. And here's some of the new material that I want to add as well. And that then gets approved, right? So the outline phase is where I get to throw all of the kitchen sink ideas in there and then see kind of what comes back. And they were very flexible, because having worked on the property for a while, I've kind of been flying since 2012, so if you can do that, that's a long time. But the really interesting part of it, I think, for me was, you know, Firefly, I had to think about why people like this show, because if you really stop and think about some of the analysis that were done in the show, it's not as compelling as the story or the characters. I mean, people really like the show for the characters. So I wanted to do a section of the book, and it's a good third of the book that retells, it's called a narrative retelling of the story so far. So it's including the comics, it puts everything in chronological order, and it goes back to some show notes and some world building notes that Joss had as well. So you get this complete picture of what Firefly is really like. And for me, I feel like that's a really important section of this book, because that's the reason why we liked the show in the first place. It, you know, we like shows because we're feel connected to the characters, not necessarily because this plot, there's a lot of things that happen or there's a scary thing that comes out, you know, Reavers, for example, or when they occur. It's because we feel that emotional connection to the characters. So I felt that that was a big part of this book, is to make sure that that feeling was still there. And the only way to really replicate that feeling for me was through a retelling or the ability to tap into the story. So that was a lot of it.
How much of your retelling goes back to the war?
Some of it does, because what happened is, in the show, if you remember, they have the first bit before the show credits. It's usually called the prelude. Some mm-hmm. people call it Act One, where they would do Battle of Hastings, or not in this case, Battle of Hastings is a completely different military campaign in the real world. But
yeah, that
Battle
first
of Serenity
that,
Valley, and,
right?
Pardon?
I said no. That first battle we saw. It's like, we're too pretty to die.
Yeah, exactly. So a couple of those battles that showed up in the show, and also through flashback conversations, Zoe had a flashback conversation about the Griswolds, the apples mm-hmm. that were thrown over the battlefield. So the war does feature into it, because really that is the reason why Mal decided not to join or be a member of the Alliance Light Society, is because he lost the war, basically. And that was a big driving force behind the show. And as a, it's not necessarily an allegory, but it's definitely inspired by what happened in the American Civil War. That military aspect of it is part of the story. So it's definitely included. The challenge is the specifics, right? Because when a story is retold, they don't always tell you, this is the ammunition of the gun, this is how far it shoots, this is the name of the specific place. And I mean, we went through everything. Like, my editor was like, do you know what the name of this building was? And I'm like, I do not know what the name of the building was. So we didn't want to make anything up, right? Because we wanted to be true to the material and make sure that everything was there. And then if somebody decides to extrapolate it, you know, with Joss's blessing for the novels, for example, they can do that. But for my purposes, I went with what was there.
So, yeah, because it's just so obvious how much what they went through the war, both Mal and Zoe, how, you know, that actually shapes who they are and mm-hmm. how they react to stuff when we meet them. So I love that sort of deep dive backstory, because you see what happened to them and you can interpret for yourself how that makes them behave. And that, to me, mm-hmm. you know, that makes me enjoy the characters more, because they didn't just land there. They had a life right. before you entered their story, and understanding how that shaped them is a big part of understanding them.
Yeah, and it's very unusual in science fiction shows sometimes. Like, I'm thinking about, okay, you're totally going to laugh at me, but like Earth 2, right? Like,
yeah.
where there are a bunch of astronauts that land on this, we hear this story all the time, it's a bunch of astronauts that land on this foreign rock, and they don't know anything about it, and they're going to discover a lot about themselves, and which is great, but they were people before they became astronauts. And sometimes, I think as we get into deeper forms of storytelling and science fiction, as the genre continues to expand with the amount of people that are very excited about it, in part thanks to, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek and Firefly, and other, Babylon 5 is another one, people really want to know more about the characters as opposed to the creepy alien that's hiding behind the rock. So, you know, knowing more about what makes somebody tick, and also if they're able to change, because that's a big part of the character. I think that really means a lot, because, you know, Mal doesn't necessarily change his MO. He loses his face, and the only way he gets it back is by fighting the Alliance. Like, he's never left the war, even after the war is over. And I feel that that's a very big tell to his character, because when you start thinking about what that means in the context, like, somebody never left fighting, well, that means a lot of things. They're in survival mode. They're going to have challenges with connections, attachments, relationships, because they're afraid of either losing them or they're afraid of somebody getting hurt. It informs a lot. And, with Mal being the leader of the ship, it almost, I don't think he could have done it necessarily without Zoe's backup, because the two of them, in a way, are, even though she's more well-adjusted than he is, the two of them, in a way, are still fighting the war every time they fly.
Yeah. And so was there anything while putting this particular book together that you hadn't seen before or that surprised you because you interpreted it a different way?
Not so much. Just because I have so much experience with the property. I think, I take that back. There was one thing that surprised me. So the story... We talk about how stories inform writers all the time. And one of the things about Firefly that's always come up as a point of discussion is whether or not it's a space opera, meaning, it's more science fiction than anything else, or it's more Western. And as I was doing the analysis portion of it for the scripts, I was able to track down the original story and the original writer who informed the movies that this show kind of inspired, because Joss intended it to be more of a Western than just in space. And that surprised me, because when I realized that it was Ernie Haycox who wrote a lot of Western stories in the 1890s, early 1900s, and that led to, I believe it was Stagecoach was the name of the movie, and there were a couple of other films as well. It just showed me how much stories published inform writers no matter when they're published. Here's this idea from the late 1800s that, past the Civil War, that informed modern storytelling. And seeing that kind of timeline is right up my geek thumb. So, being able to... kind of trace it back and see what that meant was very interesting in a lot of ways.
And that's funny, because I'm a huge fan of Westerns, which is what initially caught my attention to the show. And the way it was set up, I could see that it was a Western that just happened to be in space. It was a space opera. It was a Western. And if you look at a lot of space opera on television, it seems to be set up either in the Western style or the shall we say medieval courts of Europe style. And the space opera to me was always the new Western frontier, the new place to explore, to flex your individualism and to fight the bad guys. And that was always so obvious to me. And the fact that Firefly did it so well and that we were cut short way, way too soon has always been just, this is probably going to be one of my all-time top five favorite shows for the rest of my life. Babylon 5 is another one. Don't get me wrong, but
yeah, I'm a huge B5 fan. I really like B5 for many different reasons. It's really fascinating, to me, because there's a I'm gonna go off topic just a little bit, but there's a documentary called The Toys That Made Us.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix. They have a really, really great episode about Star Trek and another one about Star Wars. And both of them talk about the history of the shows and put it in the context of the Western, how Star Trek was supposed to be basically a Western, where it's going out on these new frontiers. And I never really thought of Star Trek that way. I mean, part of it might have been because I was a huge Next Generation fan, and I came into the property late. Like, I was more of a Star Wars person first, and then, you know, kind of grew to appreciate other fandoms and, you know, fell in love with Next Generation and some of the social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting to me just how much the idea of this new frontier and all of the problems that creates, right? Because when you go into a new frontier, we have histories of different peoples treating each other here on you know, in reality, very badly. You know, I don't want to sugarcoat it, but I also don't want to bring the tone down for the interviewer. But of course, you know, there was genocide committed. There was a lot of these atrocities committed.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of exploring something new in space raises a lot of ethical questions, and I think science fiction does that and is able to handle that very well, which is one of the reasons why Firefly is so unusual, and I think people feel better about loving it, because you don't have anybody in space. They're all abandoned. It's just each other that you have to deal with, and that is one of the ways that it gets around some of those really tricky and very gut-wrenching and very emotional scenes, is that it's, you're just fighting each other. There's no ethics about, you know, oh my gosh, we're going to wipe out this alien species. It's really just about dealing with survival and yourself.
Mm. Now that's funny. I had never heard that about Star Trek. I mean, I had always heard that Battlestar Galactica was supposed to be wagon train in space. That's how it was originally, the original version was pitched. But I never heard the comparison of Star Trek to a Western before. That's curious to me. I see it, but it's still, yeah.
The documentary, you have to see this documentary. It's so good. Because they go into a lot of that. And I felt that it really helped me better appreciate and also understand the history of science fiction on the show and television front, on the movie and television front. Because these people are trying to pitch these ideas for film, and you have a lot more flexibility often in prose. So to be able to, you know, pitch it, you have to figure out a context for it, because nothing else existed like it at the time. So how do you, well, I mean, sure, they had Flash Gordon, you know, which inspired, which is rumored, I should say, to have inspired part of Star Wars. And you had some of the older science fiction, Metropolis. I don't know if you've seen Metropolis. That's
mm-hmm.
a classic. But a lot of those were about utopias, and it wasn't necessarily about the new frontier. So it's really interesting, because it just kind of puts it in context and how other people that weren't necessarily familiar with science fiction novelists or the entire genre, they started catching on to it. It's pretty fascinating.
Cool. So
very much a deep dive into nerddom.
Oh, which is why we are here, right? We are here to explore new frontiers, to distract us from the fact that we're like eating mac and cheese on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
So what else are you working on? What other fandoms are close to your heart?
Well, I told you I was a Whovian. I haven't worked on it yet, but hoping one day that would be super cool. That would be super cool.
Well,
I really like Doctor Who for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, Titan does a lot with Doctor Who, so you've already got a foot in the door.
That's right, but I'm not British. that was meant to be a joke, and please, if any of my editors are listening, that was meant to be a joke. And I'm also, the other two fandoms that I haven't worked on yet is Hellboy, huge Hellboy fan, and also Star Wars. But yeah, I really like Hellboy. Go ahead.
So have you done anything with Hellboy? Because I think there's a new movie coming out next summer, right?
Oh, I have not, but I totally want to. I used to be the marketing director for CJ Exit Games, and they did some Hellboy stuff before my time, and I was just drooling over the fact that they had these, you know, graphic novel sized role playing games and little miniatures. I have the little miniatures around here somewhere, but
nice.
I'm afraid to paint them because I don't want to wreck them with my castle paint. But and then I guess if you could consider Lovecraft a fandom, I'm not really sure. Because I write Lovecraft for different reasons than people might think. So, but I'm not really sure if that could be considered a fandom or not.
I would call it a scholar, a student.
A scholar, a student. Okay. I study Lovecraft to basically tell more inclusive stories and examine it from different characters' points of view. I have a story coming out in an anthology called Sisterhood, Dark Tales, and Secret Histories. That's from Chaosium Publishing, who did the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, they did a lot of Lovecraftian fiction. They are rebooting their fiction line, and this anthology, which is insane, like the people that are in this anthology, it's like they got Llewellyn to write a story in it, and it's just insane. The story that I wrote is a prequel to The Dunwich Horror that takes Lavinia Whateley, who is one of the, if not the only woman that Lovecraft wrote about, and turns her into a hero. So you find out why she speaks the way she does and why she seems a little bit dull in the story. But yeah, so I like horror a lot, but I often feel that horror is for everyone. And I want to do tellings where they're not just slated towards one perspective. Because horror tends to be a lot about combat or things that you can fight. And with that amount of power and strength, people often assume that only certain types of characters can pick up a gun, or that strength only means fighting back with a knife. And I like to try to broaden that perspective a little bit, because people experience horror in everyday situations all the time. So, you know, it's not just about a character like River, who is very powerful and somebody that was needed, quite frankly, to be able to show that you can have characters that aren't just, you know, Rambo style, to, you know, use a character from the 80s. That fights against these impossible things. But there's different levels of strength. And sometimes I think that, you know, ghost stories are really good to explore that as well. But for me, the Lovecraft, I find his fatalism interesting. Let's just put it that way. Because it's hard to maintain a story where you know everybody's going to die, or you know anybody can't win. The unwinnable story is very hard to pull off. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I explore that, is because I think that that runs completely opposite to what I believe. I believe there's always a way. So, you know, diving into what I don't believe to tell a story is a challenge for me, but that's part of the reason why I do it.
Cool. Cool. Excellent. So tell everyone where they can find you and your works online.
Sure thing. Please come join the party. I am in deadline hell at the moment. So my blog is a little suffering from that. But in January, I'm going to be launching a Patreon, and I have a newsletter which will collate all of my appearances and whatnot. I'll be at a convention called Confusion in Michigan as well.
Okay.
And my website is booksofthem.com. And when I am not writing, I'm usually cracking really awful, terrible, dry, sarcastic jokes on Twitter.
We need more humor on Twitter. The sly, snarky kind of humor that I enjoy. So we will definitely have links to that where people can find you and join in the snarky joke telling.
Yes, sometimes it's so dry, even I don't get what I just said. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But a lot of people use Twitter to, you know, test jokes. I use it as a stress reliever, because there's a lot of things that are out there in the world today to be miserable about. So I try to bring a little bit of levity, a brevity, one of the two, the levity words.
Why not both?
Why not both? That's right.
Cool. Oh, Monica, thank you for your time today.
And thank you very much for having me. This was super fun.
Monica Valentinelli, the author of the new Firefly Encyclopedia, out from Titan Books. We'll have links to that. And it's a pretty thing. You should go check it out if you're a Firefly fan. But we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks, and you have bitten off a nice big chunk of Slice of Sci-Fi.
And that'll be it for Slice of Sci-Fi for 2018. We're going to take a break for the winter holidays and come back with some fresh science fiction, paranormal, and horror in 2019. Thank you all for listening, for supporting, for just enjoying the shows and the interviews and the commentary we've supplied you for this year, for everything that we have done for the sci-fi fan in all of us. I hope everyone enjoys their Christmas break, their holiday break, whichever winter holiday you happen to celebrate. Find your favorite binge and watch it or read it. I know I was planning to binge watch Lord of the Rings, the original trilogy, again, but I have a standing appointment with my Matador trilogy books. The first three books in the trilogy by Steve Perry, of course. The books are The Man Who Never Missed, the second book is Matadora, and the third book is The Machiavelli Interface, and I will be reading those three sometime this coming week, Christmas week. And if my count is correct, I think this will make 31 years in a row that I have read this trilogy once a year. It's only been my Christmas tradition for about the past 15 or 16 years, but this is a trilogy I have read every year since they first came out, which I believe was between 86 and 87. So yeah, this makes 31 years that I have read this series. Not sure which day, because I still have to finish, Alex White's A Big Ship at the End of the Universe, at the Edge of the Universe, and the second book, A Bad Day for the Whole Galaxy, I think that got the name right. I have that in my hot little hand, so I'll be able to jump right from book one to book two, but more importantly, even more important than the best Christmas movie out there, which for me is a tie between Die Hard and Scrooged. Yes, Die Hard is a Christmas movie. I don't care what Bruce Willis says. He's wrong. It's a Christmas movie. And Scrooged is just now iconic as a Christmas movie. Call the police! And, but Comet TV has sparked my interest, not only because they are rerunning Babylon 5, they are doing a Babylon 5 marathon on Christmas Day. Starting 10 a.m. Eastern on Christmas Day, they are doing a best of marathon all day of Babylon 5 episodes. I don't know which episodes are up yet. I should probably check their website to find out which ones are going to be aired. It's not going to be continuing in the regular 9 p.m. airing of the series that they're doing. So I may just lounge on the sofa and watch Babylon 5 all day, something I haven't done in a while. So looking forward to that. If I run out of things between Babylon 5 and my favorite space opera and possibly my new favorite space opera novels, Runaways, Marvel's Runaways just dropped on Hulu. Season 2, so I have that to binge, and if I'm not mistaken, Lucifer just appeared on Netflix within, I'm going to say sometime within the past week, and that's a good sign, because maybe that means that Netflix is preparing to drop Season 4 for us. Yay for that. So I may indulge in a little bit of Lucifer season one and season three, probably. Not sure if I'll get around to that, but we'll see. But definitely Babylon 5 on Christmas Day, Marvel's Runaways season 2, the Matador trilogy, and the first two books of Alex White's Salvagers series. So if you're planning to binge on something during this holiday season for Christmas and New Year's, let us know. Are you planning to go sci-fi? Are you planning to go horror? We saw Joe Bob's Christmas drive-in. The marathon was Phantasm, all the Phantasm movies. So that was kind of cool. What are you planning to binge this holiday season? Give us a call. The number is 602-635-6976. Or you can send an email to summer@sliceofscifi.com. You know, Firefly is on Netflix too, so there's a potential binge in itself. Slice of Sci-Fi, you can listen to us on iTunes, on Google Play, on Stitcher, and on TuneIn. You can leave us a review on iTunes or on Stitcher. Please head on over there if you're a subscriber through them. Leave us a review. Let people know that they should check out the show for themselves because you say so. You are enjoying the show and you recommend that they check it out for themselves. You can conversate with us on Twitter. We're at Slice of Sci-Fi. Yeah, I do answer a lot of the tweets, questions mostly. And every now and then I will comment over on YouTube. You can follow us over there, Slice of Sci-Fi. And we're on Facebook, Slice of Sci-Fi there. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on over. Leave comments on the shows, on the interviews. You can leave questions for the people we've talked to. I'll make sure they get your questions or know where to find the comments and reply to your questions, hopefully, maybe. And, of course, you can leave your own rating for the reviews of the movies and TV shows we have done. So you can have a little bit of fun with that. I'd like to thank everyone this year who has supported the shows, Slice of Sci-Fi, Writers After Dark, and of course Babylon Podcast. It does take funds to keep these shows, these websites online for everyone's continuing enjoyment. And everyone who has supported the show through Patreon and the folks still supporting through PayPal, thank you. Thank you so much. Your help has been greatly appreciated and greatly needed. So again, my continuing thanks to all of you. If you want to help support the efforts here, you can go to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. And you can also follow the paypal.me link if you want to do a one-time donation now and then. I just realized that the paypal.me link in the show notes was incorrect. So if you had tried to use that previously and it didn't work, I'm sorry. But it's fixed now. The correct PayPal link is paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. And that should, if you go to that link, it should pop up with a page. It has the little Slice of Sci-Fi logo on it. That's how you know you're in the right place. So again, thank you everyone who has supported. You've made 2018 possible and are making 2019 a continuation of, I guess it's beyond a pet project now. This is something I enjoy doing. I love doing this, and I will keep looking for ways to continue to expand the audience and to, I guess, find ways to make it profitable enough to not be a financial strain. And you guys are helping with that. So thank you again. I also want to send out my thanks to the geek rock band Sci Fried, because they have provided this show with some awesome theme music. And I love when they come out with new albums or tell me they're going on tour. If you want to find out anything about that, because you like the music you hear here, their website is sci-fried.com. But that will do it for this episode. Again, thank you everyone for listening. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi in 2019. See you then. Take care.